Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm going to be talking about the Invisible Committee's new book, which is called Now, which is published by Semiotext. And I'm going to be talking through this with Adrian, who's a communist working in Chicago at the moment. And we're going to discuss some of the themes in the book. But I guess the starting point is really sort of introducing the Invisible Committee itself, maybe sort of saying a bit about the success of some of their other books, like The Coming Insurrection.
Yeah, I suppose it makes sense, since these works are coming out now as well, to start back with the journal Tycoon, which I suppose is the sort of first incidence of this tendency of political thinking. So Tycoon is a journal that existed from 1999 to 2001. It put out two issues, it was collectively authored. And I think what, in a nutshell, what mattered about it, what was new, so to speak, was a kind of merger that was announced there between kind of what's loosely called pro-situ or sort of post-situationist thought and a kind of post-structuralist analysis. So it was, in this sense, there was a kind of eclecticism that it testified to. So it, politically speaking, it was doing something that was not typical of either kind of recognizable Marxist canon, nor kind of sort of pervasive anarchist analysis that you'd find in the 1990s. So it was bringing together a sort of mixture of things like Blanqui and Landauer, but also the Panthers and the 2nd of June movement. Politically speaking, you also had situationists alongside autonomia and Italian feminism. But it was shot through with a strong spirit of insurrectional anarchism. And so what this led to was a kind of an insurgent, acephalous communist position that didn't track along any of the sort of recognizable ideological lines and was marked by a kind of uncompromising revolutionary theory that was deeply suspicious of cheap teleology, morality, and the left. At the same time, there was a kind of philosophy that came through in all of this as well. So it wasn't strictly speaking a kind of activist or purely strategic body of thought. There was also a kind of deeply critical and, so to speak, critical theory that was being developed there as well. And it was merging things like Nietzsche and Spinoza, the way that Deleuze had brought these thinkers together, and thinkers like Agamben. And part of what that allowed was, and this was something that early works of, the middle works of Agamben have been pushing for, which is a kind of way of thinking about biopower and thinking about late capitalism and the analysis that the situationists, in particular Du Bord, had made of that at the same time. And so, you know, someone could correct me if, down the road, but it seems like, you know, it's really in the works that Agamben was writing late 80s, early 90s, mid 90s, where he was announcing this need to think Du Bord, Foucault, and Deleuze together to come up with a new sense of what revolutionary violence and revolutionary partisanship should look like. But he hadn't really worked out how that would play out. And I think it's in these texts of Tikkun and later this text, The Call, where you see this synthesis happening. And what it really means is not simply a matter of trying to hold together Marxism and Foucault, but really allowing those two traditions to speak to, across one another and to reciprocally alter one another and inform one another. So you had this claim there that, you know, what's been called biopolitics, in fact, is conducted to us through the spectacle or the spectacular relationship to ourselves, our way of inheriting a sense of ourselves as fundamentally imagistic or based on predicates, qualities. At the same time as you have an analysis of capitalism or the spectacle as a mode of governance, so not as a pure wage relation or as a something that's subsumable under a logic of exploitation, but as a kind of governance that's happening at the very level of life and experience, what Kamat had called anthropomorphism of capital. That's just a few words about the intellectual roots of this project. And that can be found in the analyses of Tikkun.
That's sort of where, you know, it's very, these are kind of key sort of common themes that are almost sort of on, you know, on everybody's lips in kind of critical theoretical circles. But, you know, the committee do something, you know, that kind of marks them out as unique, not least actually in terms of the sort of writing style and the invisible committee nature of how they, or perhaps he, she, they, make interventions. And I guess the sort of framing for this and where, you know, those themes have kind of, and that project has come to bear is in this idea of a kind of like a current crisis, which sort of frames the book. And I guess, you know, given that there are lots of different takes on crisis at the moment, what it'd be good to hear about, you know, that kind of sense of the Invisible Committee and a current crisis.
I might just start a bit earlier. In part, the language of crisis is a fraught vocabulary.
Yeah.
In the sense that it's at one hand that we can say there is a crisis implies that we can feel something is deeply wrong with this world. And there's an analysis here of the register within which it's useful to think about alienation or suffering, or to base a kind of theory of restitution, or, you know, the term Tikkun actually, you know, means a messianic restitution of existence. And so there's an analysis that says, you know, that our world is deeply broken, that the subject is deeply broken, that we have no longer any ties or roots or sense of place or identity or purpose. And so there's an intervention in that philosophy of alienation. But there's also a deep suspicion of the way that crisis theory is deployed as a strategy of power. I think these sort of concerns come together in 2003 in a text called The Call, which in some ways is the first Invisible Committee text. And this is written anonymously, it's unsigned, and it circulates hand to hand in France and across Europe. And what it's saying is essentially that, you know, we need to recognize that capitalism has taken more from us than just our labor or the value of the commodities we produce, or the means of production as a sort of like capacity to reproduce our subsistence and to survive. But that what modernity has as a whole signified is the perpetual evisceration and emptying out of the capacity to live a vibrant and dignified and meaningful life with one another. And that is a wider problem. They call it the emptying out of worlds. I think what's happening here is there's a certain kind of analysis coming from Federici and other Italian feminists, but also people like Ivan Ilyich, and a certain kind of primitive accumulation conversation. And it's being reread as a communist, from a communist ethical position as opposed to an economic position. And what happens in this text is they essentially argue that all of the stratagems that we've developed, whether that be those of the New Left during the worker, those of the workers' movement during its height, or even those of an anarchist subculture that's kind of inherited that, whether that be punk or squatting or so on, have all managed to contribute at, during certain moments, the ability to live collective power and to feel a sense of purpose and so on, to move against this modernity, but that they've all ended up routed and defeated, including the most vibrant and richest, most of the recent traditions, which was that of the Italian Autonomia movement in the 70s. And that now to pick up the scraps, to pick up the ashes of that insurgent communist project requires a certain rupture with the left. And this is something that the call produced a lot of controversy about, which was essentially their argument that we need to not seek these kinds of loose coalitions across all broad social democrat and kind of Marxist-Leninist and sort of broad citizenal, other kinds of nonprofit sectors, that loose, what in Germany they call the Bündnis, or the sort of wide coalition of interests, won't produce the kind of multi-generational communist force that's necessary to actually relaunch the project of a revolutionary movement. And so instead, we need to secede from the left and build, beginning from dense nuclei, or what they call communes, a new revolutionary movement on new premises. And so the Tardak commune was founded shortly thereafter. And this is this enters into a whole story that begins to concern the coming insurrection and the Tardak 9 case as well. I'm not sure if you want to talk about that here, or if you'd rather turn directly toward now.
No, actually, this is really fascinating, and I think, you know, kind of framing the book, and I guess the kind of politics of the book's production would be really, really useful.
All right. I suppose a word or two about Tardak 9 is and that case is important. So Tardak is a small town located in the center of France, in the Limousin region, which is a region that's known for having been a stronghold of resistance during Second World War, and also having been one of the areas to which a certain post-68 generation tended to relocate after the sort of crest of that movement had fallen. And so Tardak becomes a place where a certain kind of concentration of communist activity begins to happen in the mid-2000s, shortly after the call is created. And on November 11th in 2008, police raided the village where maybe 15, 20 people had moved and taken over a grocery store and were kind of living collectively. There are 20 arrests that happen in total. 9 are formally charged approximately a year later, and this becomes the Tardak 9 case. And one of the things that's important about this case, particularly in the U.S., after we've just seen the recent criminalization of the Trump inauguration protesters and so on, is that there was a use made of anti-terrorist law to try and criminalize what they called a criminal association for the purposes of terroristic activity. And it essentially becomes a way of criminalizing the very bond that people have with one another, more rather than specifically a set of deeds. Now, the claim is also that there was sabotage of the TGV lines that supposedly these people were responsible for. It is the case that in late of October and early November of 2008, there were horseshoe-shaped iron bars that were placed across power lines during the night. In various points across France that delayed 160 trains. But when these arrests happened, it became clear very, very quickly that there was virtually no evidence that the people in this small town, Tardak, had done this act. And one of the few things that allegedly linked them to this was this assertion that they had written this book called The Coming Insurrection, which has some lines in it about sabotaging metropolitan flows of capital, including the high-speed train lines or the TGV. And so in a sense, the book becomes one of the pretexts for criminalizing this group of young communists who've resettled in central France and are trying to relaunch a kind of commune, a communist movement based upon small, dense nuclei or, of practices and bonds and people living together. And so what happens there is that it launches the coming insurrection into the public eye. It becomes a bestseller in France. When it's translated into the U.S., this, you know, almost forgettable now talking head named Glenn Beck on Fox News, who had a show back then, you know, picked up the book and waved it around and said, look, the anarchists are coming. You know, there's going to be this new, you know, revolutionary, autonomous, terroristic force we have to watch out for. It's kind of this fear-mongering. But, you know, all it did was just create a massive audience for this book, which sold thousands of copies here as well. And so they entered the limelight, both through state criminalization, but also as the alleged authors of this this tract. And one of the things that's immediately notable about the coming insurrection is that it says something that I think most people had not at this point heard. Certainly those who, you know, were not in small far left circles in France who might have heard of de Kooning or the Call. And so in a way, for most people in the West, the coming insurrection was the first time they'd encountered this tendency of thinking. And one of the things that it said was that, you know, we need to learn how to see the West and Western imperialism, what they called empire, as and a kind of relativistic, nihilistic attitude that we seem to take for granted, as many of us, as precisely a form of government, a form of power that courses through us, and that our inability to take ourselves, our ideas, our perceptions, our own experience seriously, to feel a degree of certainty and belief in ourselves, in what we perceive, in our reaction to the world, in a sense, a kind of disconnect between experience and our own feeling of, you know, what's legitimate to do or say. That breakage in us is precisely a function of government. In fact, it's not only one function, but it's the primary function in which the economy rules our lives. And so, in a nutshell, what they're saying is that truth, understood in a certain way, is the very element, the very medium of communism, and that is the insurgent force that we need to rebuild as an experience of collective perception based in a kind of collective sense of our own perception, our own sensibility, kind of, the ability to refuse to distance ourselves from our own experience. So the coming insurrection basically says every insurrectional process begins from a truth that people refuse to be dissociated from, that genuine political affinity is always affinity within such collective experiences. And in this way, it announced a departure from a certain ideological conception of solidarity. For example, one based on ascriptive identities, you know, blackness or citizenship or whether religious or ethnic identity, but also no less a kind of leftist subculturalist identity of political positions and ideological sectarianism and so on. It said, you know, those are not the basis around which these predicates, these ideologies are not the basis around which a force should be assembling itself. And so instead of that, we should see composition, the need to build a party, as playing out in different ways. So rather than looking for who we think we would agree with, or, you know, assuming that our comrades are to be found, you know, amongst people who look like us, who speak like us, who say, you know, apparently participate in the same subculture as us, what we should be looking for are people who see the same things as us, who feel attached to the things we feel attached to. And in that way, our relationship, our, so to speak, what we've come to call our affective ties to the world, are more fundamental than our identities or our ascriptive ideas. Sort of the way we describe the world matters less than the way the world feels to us, the way that we encounter it. And in that sense, the coming instructions said all bonds today under empire are criminals. None are innocent. And that every time you find someone with whom you share a sense of power or conviction or someone, there's a tiny spark of communism in that. And that those certainties, if they are pursued, you know, uncompromised in an uncompromising way, will lead us to defection, to combat, to war. So in a nutshell, it was saying every ethical certainty today is political, that that's the living ground of politics, and that we need to relaunch the concept of communism through this new reading of experience. And that that will push us, if we take that idea seriously, to revise our understanding of what a commune in communism is. That we can break with these sort of painful, moralistic, punishing milieus and organizations of the left, of the far left, or what have you, that only seek to reproduce themselves, that attenuate every lived truth in that process, essentially become narcissistic kind of echo chambers, right? And go back out into the world, right? And look for those bonds where they are in the world, not based upon sort of preconceived ideas, but upon who is seeing the same thing and reacting in ways that resonate with one another and building upon those connections. So it's a call to, like I said earlier, to break and secede from a certain leftist habitus, a certain kind of cultural, political milieu, and go out and say, you know, the communist force you're looking for, it starts somewhere else. It starts in people's way of encountering one another in the world through practice. And you know, we should be looking for comrades in places we don't actually traditionally think to look.
I mean, these themes actually right through from the criminal case through to questions about, you know, kind of solidarity or bond building, the idea of, you know, kind of friendships are all in now. But now is the third book they've done. Or the third book from the committee, and it's interesting how these, you know, these themes are still there, and I guess it would be good to kind of pick up on a few of these. So we might just kind of throw around a couple of kind of key things from the chapters, and actually, you know, thinking about their own sort of, or you know, the potential involvement with the state, is this sort of question about kind of rioting and, you know, the sort of active responses to the French state. So I wonder if you could say a little bit about, you know, where these kinds of I guess kind of themes come up in their practical political analysis that comes up in the first sort of three chapters or so.
Yeah, sure. I think maybe one of the original theses of Now, which was, you could find elements or traces of it in The Coming Insurrection or in the book that followed it, To Our Friends. But I think it's most explicitly developed and worked out in Now is this idea that what we're encountering, what we're going through, is a kind of implosive fragmentation of the West, a period that we're living through, the period of the death of hegemony. So talking about that might be a helpful way in. So
yeah, speak. Cool.
And so what I think is going on here, in a simple way to put this, is they're offering a kind of descriptive account of the anarchy of our time, of our period of history. You could sum this up in the idea that everywhere you look, unity has become problematic. Which is to say, whether we talk about, so to speak, the features that tie, so to speak, American or British or French society, with a capital S there, together, no less than in the experience of work and of labor, as well as just in everyday social life, right? There's no longer, it's very difficult, if possible at all, to say that there's anything like a majority underpinning the world today. So it's, you know, if you think about the liberal hypothesis, there was this idea that we would sort of, from Westphalia onward, we would overcome sectarianism and sort of internecine civil war of Europe by forming something like like a modern state form that can encompass all the different ideals, and that becomes a kind of thesis of what government's supposed to do. It's supposed to be this neutral instance, this Leviathan that allows us to set down our weapons and cooperate with one another across all of our differences, right? This kind of modern state ideal, right? And I think, you know, one of the things that we should see happening today is that just that idea is just totally dead. If not dead, then dying, right? And that means that things like general interest or kind of majoritarian hegemonic moral outlook that tied together the national project are now just experienced as either farcical or satirical lies or desperate nostalgic fantasies to which people are clamoring back to and failing to do so along the way. And so the Invisible Committee enter into the situation and they say, okay, great. Let's just recall a couple things. First of all, what has died or is dying was only ever a certain fiction or phantasm to begin with. So this illusory unity of the people, capital P, right, of our national identity, of a kind of human rights framework as the universal face of humanity, the Enlightenment ideal, right? These were always mythological. These were always fictions. And so the novelty of today is just that, not that the fiction is suddenly unreal, it was always unreal, but that it's lost its explanatory or disciplinary power for a lot of people. It no longer shores up respect for authority nor commands any recognition within us, right? And any professors, activists, judges, or whatever who would try and sort of speak for everyone and tell us what's good for us all, they all just seem like strange dinosaurs, especially to the generations coming up today. So one way to think about this is simply just this is sort of like the long durée of the death of God playing itself out within the political realm, right? If by that we mean that all of the signifying ideals on which the society has sort of wagered its internal consistency have now inwardly collapsed. When we talk about anarchy, the anarchy of our time, this is a thesis they take from both Rainer Schirmann and Giorgio Agamben, right? What they mean is that the more the authorities try and patch the holes and push for some kind of nostalgic unity, the more divisive those authorities become. Right? And so the anarchy there is just the groundlessness, the inability to rest any claim to legitimacy or authority on a sort of recognizable signifying foundation or hegemonic ideal. And so the proposal here is that we should not look for a new unified horizon, right? And I think this is probably one of the most controversial or distinctive features of the political current that we're talking about here. Let's say, for example, if the world is to be saved, this will be in each of its fragments, whereas the totality could only be managed, right? And to go back to the point we were making earlier, right, if communism needs to proceed from the very terrain of everyday life, right, what we're saying in terms of fragmentation is that today everyday life is fundamentally discontinuous. And the outcome of that then is that if there's political conflicts today, they will always be between minority factions. And no matter how large they are, that no one can be more than a minority faction. And that states are increasingly recognizing this kind of implosive horizon. And yet at the same time, they're equally aware that they have no sort of ideal or value that they're able to replace it with, right? And so what we're seeing is this sort of desperate, separatist, protectionist, parochial kind of compromises, Brexit, America First, or Duterte's drug war, right? These sort of desperate measures that try and clamp down on something like a smaller, more minority sense of social fabric. Out of the impotence to replace it with anything like a wider big tent political vision. So the classical train of politics, the field of classical politics has internally imploded, and there's no ideal to replace it. And their claim is that this fragmentation cannot be reversed artificially from above by force, whether that be by panic, fear, or brutality. And there's a wager here, right? And this could turn out to be wrong. But their wager is that no left populist recuperation will manage to do this either, right? And we could certainly try to imagine kind of Bernie Sanders figure or Corbyn or some other sort of thing coming along in Britain or the United States. But I think, you know, if we look at Spain, if we look at Greece, right, it's fairly clear that they have not been able to stop the crisis. They've not been able to turn around austerity, and that the, so to speak, hegemonic power or populism that they hope to recreate through the sort of new rebooted social democracy isn't working and it isn't solving the problem. And so as you go, as you sort of take stock of all of this, this internal implosion, you have to at the same time recognize that, you know, through all of this, everyday people, whoever that is, not the professional politician class, have already undergone a kind of disinvestment, that there's been a kind of massive desertion of the field of classical politics that's accompanied this. Even if that's largely been interior or sort of immobile, meaning it hasn't produced a lot of outward expressions. And here one could disagree with the thesis or not, right? It's not something that we can empirically verify. But their wager is that as we see classical politics imploding, the liberal hypothesis being emptied out, we can also assume, or we can postulate, that a lot of people are basically done with this whole horizon of representative, statist, normative politics, that it means nothing to anyone, no one gives a shit about it, and that as a result, how you speak about politics and how we imagine rebooting a communist project today needs to take stock of this and come from a different place. Their way of thinking about it, and what we're trying to think about here in terms of fragmentation, is that these fictions of the nation, the working class, the subaltern, and so on, won't be the terms around which a new partisan movement recomposes itself. And so if we look, for example, at the ruptures, to come back to your question about the riots and blockades we're seeing in the past 10 years, right? If we look at the ruptures of the past decade, think about Gezi Park or Standing Rock or the demonstrations around the labor law conflict in 2016 in France, what we're seeing we see people recomposing into fighting forces across unprecedented gaps and differences of experience. When they come together, though, the tendency is not to form a sort of newly signifying ideological structure like a political party or a constituent assembly. Rather, what they're doing is they're occupying plazas or fields, as in the case of Standing Rock, right? Blockading infrastructure, as in the Val de Susa or Notre-Dame-des-Landes, or along the Keystone XL pipeline or the Line 3 pipeline, blockades in the northern United States right now, right? And they're fighting every force that attempts to disperse them. So they're gathering, they're occupying, they're blockading infrastructure, and they're rioting, particularly in defense of those occupations, right? And that this forms the essential grammar of our contemporary political movements: riot, blockade, occupation, right? And if we looked at that, we need to recognize that, you know, all of those gestures involve moments of intense vitality, shared truth, and collective intelligence, but that none of them are attributable to any kind of recognizable sociological subject or sort of political identity that cuts across all of that. You know, it's not enough just to say, as Paul Mason and others did, right, that, like, you know, you see a kind of like downwardly mobile middle class of youth, you know, that's the new subject or so on. Like, it just doesn't work. These sorts of efforts to sort of pigeonhole the new insurgent movement within this or that group of people, and you really miss the point if you do that. Because what we're seeing in fact is the flight from a kind of classical politics that would need a kind of unified, coherent, ideologically grounded subjectivity as its vessel, as its primary mode of organizing. And what we're seeing instead is something like a bunch of fragments breaking off from the places they're supposed to be, whether it's professors or, right, firemen or you know, dejected college students or punks or, you know, bicycle messengers, right? And they're coming down to these places of where partisan life is organizing itself. And they're fighting and saying and doing things that have nothing to do with the places they're from, right? And so the common force that's being built is not indexed back to the lives we had. There's a kind of becoming or a kind of process. This is literally what the individual committee will call the commune that develops between us in these moments, that is itself the very basis around which people are composing. So the movements are producing their own foundations in and through the process of composition and battle and self-organization.
And slightly later on in the book, they sort of take this on a bit with this concept of destitution. And I guess that'd be quite a useful idea to sort of play around with as a way of sort of getting towards the kind of concluding ideas in the book, which talk about the relationship between the kind of idea of communism and a sort of destitution. So I wonder if you like give me like a little definition, or you know, maybe give a flavor of destitution before we sort of get into their eventual kind of remarks that close the book.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think in a nutshell, the problem here is we could approach it a couple different ways. First, we could just simply say that communism is not going to return. This is part of what we've been saying all along. Communism won't return to the 21st century the way it left. What we need today is to think about a new non-totalizing understanding of how, from fragment to fragment, from territory to territory, commune to commune, rupture to rupture, occupation to occupation, a new experience of communist partisanship is arising and can continue to build itself. And so one way to think of it is our time, this fragmentation I've just described, right? It's dragged us kicking and screaming back to earth, right? And the destituent problem that concerns, because just to put that a finer point on that, it's dragged us back to earth because it's denuded, emptied out, and withered all of those fictions, that those extraterrestrial sort of unifying fictions that once drove the Western political project. None of them make sense to anyone anymore. And so that's what I mean when I say that this fragmentation drives us back to earth, because we're back standing on the ground in which there are only constituted actors. There's only forces getting organized from the different places they are, whether that be the CIA, ISIS, right, Standing Rock, combatants, right? The people building these occupations at ICE offices, right? Everyone is a force on a flat surface. And that's the sort of starting point from which we must begin to think today. And the destituent problem, or destituent power, this idea that that Agamben, I think, provides perhaps the most proximate source of this idea, it concerns how to build up a force of collective, revolutionary-minded, yet irreducibly singular people that's capable of dreaming and fighting together without falling back on the decayed Western fantasies of the party, the state, the people, and so on. And so the destituent communism means approaching politics with the idea that what we're doing is creating pathways between fragments, not subsuming them in new holes. We're not here to build a new society and to act in the name of that new society that we project ahead of us. But what we're doing is we're organizing for basic social reproduction and self-reliance in joyful, experimental ways without using law or the money to bind us together. And that, you know, no matter how many and how massive the scale of this communist experimentation, and of course we hope it will continue to grow and grow in the coming decade, that no matter how big it gets, that nothing like universality is going to be there to read off of that. Every commune, every bond we share remains singular from here on out. I mean, this is sort of the ultimate upshot of the anarchy of our time, is that communism no longer should be thinking of itself as a project that gathers individuals into a new great society, but as a way of collectively organizing our lives without recourse to specious unities or specters, in ways in which all of the singularities that come together feel more powerful through that self-organization without losing the sense of their singular perspective, their own ability to see and perceive the world from their unique point of view. And, you know, of course, forces like Google and Facebook and other kinds of cyberneticians of our time want to reorganize us too, right? And perhaps see themselves as post-ideological or sort of post-political while they do that, right? But the claim is that although they promise a new kind of social composition, whether that be through social media or other sorts of sort of digital horizontality or whatever, that ultimately they offer nothing other than a sort of standardized interface through which we can interact, right? That in the long run, there's nothing like a vital life form that's going to take hold of us or that we'll be able to lay claim to through those forms. So those kinds of infrastructures are actually sort of, it's not that they're not collective, it's that they're not vital. They offer no possibility of a joyful, collective, happy force that can act and expand. So part of the wager here is to parse apart what sort of fake community of digital, social, sort of online management produces today and push for a different sense of what collective, vital, insurgent life could look like. So to pull those two visions apart and say they're not the same things, right? We don't want to become spectators on our own lives, entrepreneurs of ourselves. We shouldn't be surprised when we see phenomena like the cortège de tête, this sort of like lead procession phenomenon that happened in France where, you know, all these different people would come to the front of these union marches and basically take over the situation and riot and fight the police and so on. You know, we shouldn't be surprised to see these things cropping up more and more in our times, because the kinds of collectivity and the kinds of common experience we're offered are just, they're awful. They are impoverished. They're pathetic. No one cares about them. And we can do better. And so to put a finer point on the idea of destitution, so that's the sort of initial set of assumptions from which we need to think about a destituent project. But I think there's also a sort of, I think we'd say a couple more things about this. That destituent communism or the concept of destitution, it responds to two sort of problems, which have to do with the very vision of revolutionary power or the meaning of what a revolution is. And the first is that, so if we state, you know, in plain terms what the classical idea of revolution was, right? It's reclaiming, expropriating the world that's been taken from us, right? It's storming the Winter Palace, right? Taking over the centers of political and economic power, right? And running them in the name of the dispossessed, whether that be, right, the subaltern or right, the native kicking out the settler or the working class taking over the means of production from the bourgeoisie, right? What you have is a problem of restitution of something that's been taken, right? And to do so, you need two things. You need to understand who reclaims, right, in the name of what the revolution is carried out, and what you're reclaiming. So what is the objective world that you're taking back? Right? Part of what we're at a loss for today is to say either of those things. Neither of those questions can be answered today in the way they once were in the 20th century. So the tension of here is that destitution means that we inherit the revolutionary project and feel close to that tradition, yet we can't live its problems as if they're still our own. So we don't inherit the revolutionary movement as if, you know, it's a matter of arming the working class and affirming the labor power, you know, that you know, largely was the sort of programmatistic or sort of programmatic form that in which revolution was thought about in the 20th century. That today, whatever binds us needs to be invented through the very movement of insurgency. And so the Tikkun or Visible Community, they'll talk about this as a kind of creation of worlds or communes, right? And so that binding unity of a revolutionary force has no identity to fall back on, no name of, you know, we're doing this in the name of the people, the working class, or so on. At the same time, it doesn't have a world that it would be worth taking over. You know, we don't look out in the world and say, like, you know, I can't wait to expropriate this agro-business factory farm, right? Or, run by robots, right? I can't wait to take over this you know, nasty mess of decaying freeways so that are crumbling all over Chicago, right? Or the, you know, it's so there's not a sort of, the world we inherit is capital's world. It's not our world. You know? So whether it's on the side of the subject or the object, right, the process of revolution needs to be rethought. We need to both create a collective force that we're not able to just point to as extant, and we need to build a world and a way of living with one another that doesn't currently show itself as just ready to be expropriated out there in the world. Right? So there's a sort of identity problem and there's a practice problem built into that. I think what I would say here is that I think the destitution moment can be understood in two basic ways as a result of that. On the one hand, there's a kind of negative or destructive component there, right? So destitution means that the destruction of capital's world, the ability to blockade, empty out, and obstruct the functioning of the institutions that make the economy and the state function here. But it also means more than that. So that's a sort of negative part. But destitution goes beyond a thesis of negation or simple blockading that you can read about in, for example, Endnotes or other kind of left communist critiques today, you know, blockading choke points and so on. Because destitution has to do with not just with like obstructing the flow of commodities, but also emptying out the need we have of the institutions that they reproduce. So there's a kind of positive project involved in the very obstruction of this world. A lot of the ways that which people have started to talk about this is a kind of unity of building and fighting, living and struggling, which is to say struggles are opportunities to deepen bonds and collective affirmations and attachments at the same time as they simultaneously constitute the very positivity that we aim to defend and expand. And the trick here is there's a kind of recursive logic, right? In destruction, we build the bonds that give this destruction its positivity. And destitution aims to kind of hold together that problem as the contemporary problem of revolutionary violence, right? As opposed to in a nutshell, if the previous epoch of revolutionary struggle was about realizing the identity of the laborer or restoring identity that was been taken from them, in this one, in our epoch, it's more about deserting and fleeing the forms of impoverished life that we're offered. And through that desertion or flight, which also looks like blockading and obstructing the economy, inventing new collective forms of self-organization that are not ready-made. And we don't know what they're going to look like. So on the one hand, you can start anywhere. On the other hand, we need to recognize the gap that separates us from the old revolutionary image. And that finally, what we need to think about here is not eventually a kind of new social contract, a new constituent lawmaking agency that will come out of all of this as a new sort of representative populist project. That fundamentally, the revolutionary desire, our desire, is not to seize power and lay claim to what's been, you know, rightfully ours or what's been taken from us, but fundamentally to flee this disastrous world. And that includes the disastrous images of sort of workers' power and proletarian dictatorship that tanked that revolutionary project in the early 20th century as well. So destitution is, you know, certainly, if it's one thing, it's a kind of anti-statist image of revolutionary power.
I mean, we barely kind of scratched the surface of the book. You know, there's a lot more going on in terms of kind of, you know, specific political interventions on the French question, you know, questions about how we organize the economy in the kind of, you know, platform sort of context. I wonder, just to kind of conclude, do you get a sense of a kind of, you know, another book forthcoming, or, you know, is there a sort of set of practical projects that might flow from this? Do you have a sense of kind of what's next after now?
I mean, here again, I think what's happening, right? One would have to speak rather about what's happening currently. as opposed to what's coming next, right? Because the strategy here is not, like you said, a kind of program or blueprint so much as it is a kind of situated way of looking at potentiality for collective insurgency based upon the really existing situation. And, you know, that's an irritating answer. I realize that, but nonetheless, there's a truth in it. I think what I would rather point out is to maybe you asked earlier just for a few words about the sort of closing statement of now, like what is communism? Like, what is their sense of communism for the 21st century? Right. And so if it's all right, I might just like speak rather to that.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be good.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think what's at issue here is, you know, whatever would come next, really what comes next is we could think about that question as what comes after the sort of image of social insurgency based on a kind of like institutional paradigm where, you know, the best thing we want to do is, you know, build a new set of laws, institutions, social relations modeled on a sort of other kind of morality or something. That, since we're not doing that, what are we doing? I mean, what we're saying here is that communism is not a way of reorganizing the management of society, and it's not an alternate model of economy. That, in fact, what we want is not a different economy. It's not even a mode of human sociality per se, since it's not even strictly speaking about us. The question of communism issues today, not from an ideology, but from a kind of immemorial experience that has been, you know, arguably present since the dawn of history. And that is a feeling of community between us and the world, right? If there's something that's been taken away from us, it would be that. It's the ability to actually feel connected to places, people, and even including non-human life, right? And so fundamentally what we're looking for is not a better economic deal with society, but a form of community that's not subsumable in economic terms at all. And that what we're really pushing for here is then, you know, not a kind of picture of a transitional project, which it's fine to do, right? I mean, people who are close to the committee also wrote a book called First Revolutionary Measures, which I recommend people check out. It's sort of a, you know, a rough draft of something like a way of answering the question of what would happen if, for example, right, we had routed the police and managed to blockade the economy and actually could begin thinking about how to reorganize our lives, right? So in a sense, it thinks about these sort of transitional questions. It was co-written with Eric Hazan. So we could look at that, but I think the main idea here is that economism needs to present our lives to us in a kind of impoverished way in which we're all these individuals pursuing our collective and our sort of private interests. And then you know, how does the big question becomes how to organize these individuals in a subsuming framework. Right. I think what we're talking about instead is that we need to develop a different kind of ethics in which we learn to see ourselves not as these particles or atoms, but as relational beings made up of ties and who are always already living in a set of relationships with other people. And so I think this fundamentally changes the sort of way in which we think about politics, because if the continuation of capitalist society depends on us relating to each other as if we were these sort of like particles of interest, then we're always going to end up in that paradigm with a kind of new Leviathan at the end of the road, right? Where we're always looking for, you know, new forms of contract that tell us how to behave with one another and how to not get screwed over by one another and so on. I think what we want is to get out of that managerial paradigm of thinking about politics. And so I think, you know, recentering project, the communist project around joy, around shared affections for one another, around new forms of kinship. I would recommend people check out this book, Joyful Militancy, which, although the title is perhaps misleading, it's actually trying to sort of reframe the so-called militant politics in ways that are more centered on joy and less on kind of rigid radical identity. That just came out recently, but Nick Montgomery and Carla Bergman. I think that's another sort of way of coming at this problem of, you know, what would it mean to shift politics away from this idea that, you know, there's a way in which an institutional framework we all have to look for to govern our lives and manage our connections in sort of like fair or quote unquote democratic ways, and begin asking that different kind of question, like what would it mean to share joy and get organized with one another in ways that open up new frames of connection, new ways of living. And I realize that's a bit abstract, but I actually think that our movements today are posing these questions to us in perfectly concrete ways, right? Whether that be the movements that we've seen in the squares throughout, starting in right in Spain and Greece and moving west through the Occupy movement, whether that be the Standing Rock or other forms of situated struggle like that, or along pipelines resistance and so on. I think there's all these ways in which these movements are not only not interested in becoming a new political class, but they're saying, right, we are ready to give up the lives that we've been offered. I think you've seen this vast phenomenon of people just deserting their identities in these moments and finding other ways of living with one another. And the trick is, how do we make that into an irreversible break? And how do we scale that break up so that more and more people can feel comfortable breaking away from the kind of social dependencies that currently pin them down and feeling more free to experiment with other folks in new ways? And so I think that's what needs to come next, is a vast process of detaching from current institutional forms and throwing ourselves into a more collective experiment with one another without any preconceived idea necessarily, except maybe some rough indications of what that has to mean in advance. Yeah.